Of all the things that I could say about our next speaker, I think this is probably the best. Of all the students that we've had at the West Virginia School of Preaching, this is certainly one of them. Hunter Mallott is a lifetime resident of West Virginia. He's a 2017 graduate of the West Virginia School of Preaching. His father, Ed Mallott, has taught at the school for a number of years, and his father, Ed Mallott, graduated from school here, and so Hunter says in his biography that he is the first legacy graduate from said school. And I didn't know what that meant. I had to look it up, but that's what it means. He's the first second-generation graduate from the school, and we are happy for that. Hunter worked at the church at Oakwood Road for 2 years as an associate minister and is now currently ministering at the church in West Union, West Virginia. I'll tell you what thing that always sticks out to me about Hunter. We were in class one day, and we were studying through the book of Jeremiah. And I was about as depressed as I usually was studying through the book of Jeremiah. And I think I had great success when I got Hunter just about as depressed one day. We got through the section where Jerusalem has been destroyed. God tells them, whatever you do, don't go down to Egypt. And you know what they do? They go down to Egypt, the remnant does. And Hunter says, wow, these people, I can't believe this. He's just amazed at how sinful and stubborn those people were. That all stuck with me, that he had a heart that could see that. We appreciate Hunter very much, all joking aside, and appreciate his work and his ability to speak, and have great hopes for him and his service to the Lord, and hope for a long life of such. Hunter?
Good morning. Man, what a privilege. What an honor this is. What a blessing to be able to speak in front of all of you here at the lectures. And it's not just, you know, a privilege or an honor to speak before you because it's the lectures. I mean, you know, that's part of it, right? But any time you get up to deliver a message, to deliver God's word in front of others, whether it's before 100 people, 1,000, or even if it's just a one-on-one study with somebody. Brethren, it's always a blessing, an honor, and a privilege anytime you're able to do that. And so I'm so thankful to be able to do this. You know, it's like such a neat perspective right now. It's really kind of cool. You know, I'm standing here before, you know, Emmanuel and Bruce, and my dad, I see Paolo, and all these people that had taught me at the school. And I hear somebody say, Andy, did you teach me anything at the school? I don't know if you did or not. But, you know, it's such a cool perspective now to be able to stand in front of you guys and to be able to deliver a message. I think that's kind of what, you know, Paul talked about, isn't it? In Galatians 6, chapter 6, verse 6, when Paul said, let the one who is taught share all good things with the one who teaches. And so in a sense, that's kind of what I'm doing this morning, I guess. I'm giving back a little bit, sharing back a little bit. And we're going to be in the book of Psalms this morning. We're going to be in Psalm 125. And so if you have your Bibles with you, I would encourage you to turn there with me. Psalm 125. You know, it's important, anytime we go to study a book, anytime we go to study a psalm or something like this, it's usually important to know, you know, the author and the date of composition of the book or of the psalm. And so we have the fortunate situation this morning of knowing neither of those. So we do not know the author of this psalm, and we also don't know the date of its origin. But I do want to say something about this. You know, so many times when we go to the psalms, we look, and you know, if it doesn't say David, we think, it's probably David. Okay? And so because of that, you know, many scholars have said, well, you know, David could have written this. Maybe he didn't. But we really have no evidence to suggest that it was David, as opposed to Solomon, or as opposed to Asaph, or any other person that may have written any of these psalms. And so we really just don't know. And furthermore, I'd actually say it's probably not David, because what we find is, if you go back over to, let's see, it's going to be Psalm 122. Look at Psalm 122. And you can see there the heading of Psalm 122, and it says there, a song of ascents of who? Of David, right? Then you look at Psalm 124, and what does it say there? A song of ascents of who? Of David. Then look at Psalm 127, and it says a song of ascents of Solomon. But you know, Psalm 125 and some of the others, we don't have any of that. We don't have David or Solomon. And so, you know, we don't know who wrote this. I suppose it could have been David, it could have been Solomon. It might not have been either of them. Okay, but the thing to know is that, listen, it's okay. It's not important that we know it. We don't need to know it. We don't need to know who the author is in order to understand its teaching. What about the time that it was written? We don't really know that either. Okay, some people say that, well, you know, this may be post-exilic. So this may be, you know, written sometime in the midst of the captivity or right after the captivity. And we just don't really know. Some people say it was before the captivity. But what we do know is that the way this psalm is written and the teachings in the psalm and the language of the psalm, really, it makes us see that this psalm can actually fit in any of those time frames. It can fit before the captivity. It can fit after the captivity. It could fit right in the middle of the captivity. And so we don't really know the author, and we don't really know the exact time that it was written. But with that being said, there's still a lot in this psalm that we can take from, we can understand, and we can learn from this psalm. So I want us to go ahead and look at this psalm here. And notice, first of all, it says a song of ascents. Now, this isn't part of the text, I guess. It doesn't say verse 1 beside of it, you know. But it says a song of ascents. What does that mean, a song of ascents? Well, if you go back, Psalm 119 ends, okay, and you see Psalm 120. What does it start with there? A song of ascents. Okay, and that's going to be a common theme going all the way to Psalm 134. So you see Song of Ascents is from Psalm 120 all the way over to Psalm 134. So we have a collection of about 15 psalms here. And there's some different theories as to exactly why these are even called a Song of Ascents. Okay, there's at least three theories. The first theory is that this was a psalm, or these were a collection of psalms that were sung by the Jews on their way up to Jerusalem, on their way up to the temple in order to worship God. You know, Jerusalem was on an elevated plain, so they were walking up to Jerusalem and they were ascending up to Jerusalem. And as they were ascending up to Jerusalem, they were singing these songs. Of course, they weren't reading them. You know, we would read them, but they would sing them. And so that's one of the theories. Another theory is that, and now this theory would only work if this was post-exilic, but another theory is that the Jews would actually sing these songs in a sense of victory, thankfulness, and triumph, and that they were coming out of those foreign lands and going back up, if you were, back up into Jerusalem to worship their God, back up into their old land that they knew and that they loved, and they can get back to worshiping God. And so that's why it was a song of ascents, because now it shows the metaphorical rise, if you will, back up to Jerusalem and back up to Israel and back up to worshiping God. A third theory there is about why this is called the Song of Ascents here is that actually in the composition of the music and also in the composition of the lyricism, you see a sort of rising theme throughout the psalm. And so it starts off at one place and it builds and builds and builds and builds and gets gradually higher and higher until there comes to this climactic point in the psalm. And so those are different theories as to why it's called a Song of Ascents. Which one is it? I don't know. We really don't know. But it's just interesting to know those things, brethren, because it makes it come alive to us. Because even though we're reading these things so many, you know, years after they were written, the Song of Ascents, it meant something to these Jews. And they knew exactly what it meant. And so it could have been one of those three things. It may have been something else. But those are just some theories. Let's go ahead into the text now. And let's look at verse 1. Okay? So Psalm 125, verse 1. Let's look at the text. Those who trust in the Lord are like Mount Zion, which cannot be moved, but abides forever. Okay, here's the first thing we want to notice here. Those who trust in who? Yeah. Those who trust in the Lord. Okay. Not those who trust in Jerusalem, right? Those who trust in King David? No. Those who trust in Solomon. Those who trust in the Lord. You know, it's been a theme throughout the Old Testament that God always wanted his people to trust in him. Didn't he? Go over to 1 Samuel chapter 8 and you see that actually. You see the people there in 1 Samuel chapter 8, they demand a king. Do you remember that? They tell Samuel, look, you're getting old and your sons, they're not judging the way you did and they're not like you, you know, and we want a king. You know, we're getting tired of this. And remember, Samuel was like despondent about that. He was actually pretty sad about that. And then God tells him, look, give them a king. Samuel, they're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me. You see, God takes that personally whenever we decide that we do not want to serve him, that we want to put our trust in somebody else. And that's exactly what the Israelites were doing. They were putting their trust in kings and they were putting their trust in their own victories, so to speak, even though they technically weren't their victories. They were God's victories every time because God would enable them to win. But God wants us to put our trust in him. And the text there says, those who put their trust in the Lord. What does Psalm 20 verse 7 say? Some trust in chariots, some trust in horses, but we will trust in the name of the Lord our God. That's what's important. That's who we should trust in. It's God. And God takes it personally whenever we do not trust in him. What about those people? Those people who trust in the Lord, what are they going to be like? Well, look at the verse. They're going to be like Mount Zion, which cannot be moved but abides forever. They're going to be like a mountain. You know, he goes so far to say that not only will they be like a mountain, but they're actually going to be like the biggest mountain in Jerusalem. Mount Zion was the biggest mountain in Jerusalem. Not only are they going to be like a mountain, they're going to be like the biggest mountain in Jerusalem. In other words, it's hyperbolic language to say that that's how firm they're going to be. That's how sure they're going to be whenever they stand because they trust in the Lord. So they're going to be like a mountain. Nobody's going to be able to move them. Now this would have been interesting for the Jews. They would have liked this because they looked at Mount Zion, a good light. Let's go ahead and turn back over to Psalm 48, if you will, very quickly. Psalm 48 and verses 1 and 2. And I mean, we can see this here. You know, the Jews like Mount Zion. Psalm 48, verses 1 and 2. Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, his holy mountain. Beautiful in elevation is the joy of all the earth. Mount Zion in the far north, the city of the great king, within her citadels, God has made himself known as a fortress. So Mount Zion was something that was important to the Jews. And God said, you know what? If you put your trust in me, you're going to be like that mountain. You're going to be like Mount Zion. Okay? It can't be moved, but it abides forever. The original language there means that it stands to eternity. It's never going to go away. So not only can you not be moved, not only is it impossible for you to be moved, but you're also not going to go anywhere. As long as the contingency is there, right? And what's that contingency? Those who trust in the Lord. As long as that's there, the following is going to be there. You're going to be like a mountain. You can't be moved. And you're going to stand forever. Okay? So let's look at verse 2 now. Because the first one was talking about the people who trust in the Lord. But now verse 2 is talking about the Lord. As the mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds his people from this time forth and forevermore. Okay, Jerusalem was surrounded by a bunch of mountains, and here this is just symbolic language, and if you will, a symbolic picture of this. Jerusalem was surrounded by all these mountains, and he said, as the mountains surround Jerusalem, and think of the audience here, I mean, this would have been a Jewish audience, and he said, you know, as the mountains surround Jerusalem, you're aware of this, so God's going to surround you. God will surround his people. And he says, from this time forth, right? So right now he will. And then to when? Forevermore. He always will. And so what we see here is that if you trust in the Lord, you're going to be like a what? You're going to be like a mountain. It's going to be able to stand. Nobody can move it. And it's going to stand how long? Forever, right? And now we read, not only that, not only will you be like a mountain, but guess what? You're also going to have somebody who's going to be surrounding you to protect you, even though, you know, nobody's going to move you anyway. Somebody's going to be able to protect you and surround you constantly. And guess how long he's going to be there? Forever. Just like that mountain that can't be moved and that sits there forever. But then we go to verse 3 and we think, well, hold on now. Is there a contradiction here? This is a little weird. I mean, we see the first two verses. What about verse 3? This is kind of odd, isn't it? Look at verse 3. For the scepter of wickedness shall not rest on the land allotted to the righteous, lest the righteous stretch out their hands to do wrong. Well, what does this mean, you know? What is it? What are you talking about? The land, the scepter of wickedness will not rest on the land allotted to the righteous? Well, if we're taking this at its face value and just reading it, well, that's just plain wrong, isn't it? Because the scepter of wickedness, in other words, wicked rule, certainly rested on the land of the righteous, didn't it, in a sense? Well, either internally or externally, right? So you have wicked kings from Israel, or you have wicked kings from other nations. So what do we do with this? Well, here's what we do with this. There's an important word here. It's the word rest. Now, I don't know, you know, all the translations. I know New King James says rest, ESV says rest. I don't know about the ones that you're using. But the word rest, that's the important word here. It's not going to rest. In other words, it's not going to stay. The scepter of wickedness, in other words, the rule of wicked people, is not going to stay on the land allotted to the righteous. It's not going to stick around. It's not going to be there forever. And why is that? Well, the psalmist goes on to say, lest the righteous stretch out their hands to do wrong. In other words, you know, there's a remnant. But what's going to happen is, if that wickedness is just in that land forever, then what's going to happen to that remnant? Well, that remnant's going to eventually fall off, going to get killed off, okay? And so the righteous will basically completely be depleted. And so that's why God's not going to allow the wicked to just rest on the land allotted to the righteous. Not only that, because he had to bring Christ into the world. But, you know, this passage actually reminds me of a parable in the Old Testament. Love this parable. I mean, it's one of my favorite parables. And, you know, most of the time when we talk about the favorite parables we have, we're talking about the New Testament, right? I mean, because that's where almost all the parables are. But there's a few parables in the Old Testament. One of them is in Ezekiel chapter 17. And it's a parable of the two eagles and a vine. You remember that parable? You know, it talks about this great eagle, and he had great big talons and big wings and great plumage. And he goes to Lebanon, and he takes the top of a cedar. He goes back in a foreign land and plants it, remember? And we remember who that eagle was. That eagle was Nebuchadnezzar. And it was, you know, the cedar was Israel, and the twigs was the young king at the time in Israel. And then we see later on, you know, that twig that he planted, he made it to grow like a willow tree. And what that means, you know, is it was been a willow tree, so it was stooping and growing towards something. And it was growing towards that eagle. And so basically that's there to represent that that would have been Zedekiah, who was going to be a vassal king for Nebuchadnezzar, that he was going to serve Nebuchadnezzar. And then we see that second great eagle that comes in, remember? And that eagle is Pharaoh Hophra of Egypt. And that's when Zedekiah made that alliance with that Pharaoh. And what happened with that alliance, by the way? Andy said it earlier in the intro, but you know, they were never supposed to have dealings with the Egyptians again. They weren't supposed to go back to that land. They weren't supposed to make any alliances with them. And what does Zedekiah do? He makes an alliance with Egypt, and God ends up telling him, you know what's going to happen? You think they're going to help you out when Babylon comes to destroy you? They're not going to help you at all. And they didn't, by the way. But what, and this is the whole reason I'm bringing this up, by the way, what ends up happening? You see Nebuchadnezzar, and you see Pharaoh Hophra, and oh my goodness, I mean, look, the land of Israel is getting destroyed again. But what about, how does the parable end? God says, you know what? I will take myself. I myself will take a sprig from the top of a cedar and plant it, and it shall become a tree, right? And in it shall be able to be nested all sorts of birds of all different types. And what he's talking about is Jesus and the church. And so God always gives a little bit of hope. The psalmist says here, you know what? You're not going to let the wicked scepter rest on the land. They're not going to be able to stay there forever. You're not just going to let them rule completely. God in the Old Testament, even though he punishes Israel, even though he tells them what he's going to do, he always gives them some hope at the end if they would just turn back from their wickedness and repent, ask for forgiveness, and they would receive God's grace, and they would receive God's mercy. That's all. That's what the psalmist here is trying to tell us. The scepter of the wickedness is not going to rest on the land allotted to the righteous, because God cares about his people, and God doesn't want his people just to be completely destroyed and want his people just to completely abandon him. He wants there to be righteous people that serve him. Look at verse 4. Do good, O Lord, to those who are good, and to those who are upright, in their hearts. You know, that's a that verse, do good, O Lord, to those who are good. What an amazing concept that is. Do good to those who are good. Who's good? Let me ask that question. Is it somebody who's perfect? Well, okay. You know, in the strictest sense, yes, I guess, because Jesus was good, right? And he was perfect, okay? But I'm not talking about Jesus right now. I'm talking about us. I'm talking about human beings. You know, Jesus was the only person to come to this earth to keep the law perfectly and never sin. But I'm talking about us. Who's good? Is it somebody who's perfect? Is it somebody who never does wrong? Is that what he's talking about here? Do good, O Lord, to those who are good. Do good to those who check off all the boxes. Do good to those who work great works of righteousness only for themselves. Do good to those who are just worried about appearance. Is that what he's talking about here? Is that the good people here? Now, let me show you what a good person is. Go back to Psalm 119 in verse 67. Man, I love these set of verses here. Psalm 119, starting verse 67. You know, this is what a good person is. Here David writes, before I was afflicted, I went astray. But now I keep your word. Go to verse 71. It is good for me that I was afflicted, that I might learn your statutes. Man, I want you to think about something. That's a good heart right there. That's a good person. He said, before I was afflicted, I went astray. Now I keep your word, though. And you know what? It was good that I was afflicted. It's actually good that I was persecuted. It's good that I faced some hardship. And why is that? Why is that good to feel pain? Why is it good that you were afflicted? Because now I keep your word. That's a good person. That's a good heart. Isn't that what it says in Psalm 125? Look at the rest of the verse. Do good, O Lord, to those who are good and to those who are upright in their hearts. You know, what was David called? You know, by the way, probably most of you guys are thinking a man after God's own heart, right? Probably. I mean, I can't read your minds, but I'm just guessing, all right? You know, I bet none of you are thinking, well, he was probably called a murderer. He's probably called an adulterer. He might have been called a liar. Okay? You think he was called all those things at one point in his life? Well, yeah, because he did all those things, right? You know, he slept with another man's wife and then he killed that man. But you know what God calls him? A man after my own heart. And you know why? It's because you have sin in life. You have things that you do wrong in life. But it's all about your attitudes, and it's all about repentance, and it's all about, you know, seeking mercy and having that good heart that God knows. That's the type of person David was, and that's the type of person that God is going to protect. Look at verse 5. But those who turn aside to their crooked ways, the Lord will lead away with evildoers. Peace be upon Israel. Okay, we have in the language here, those who turn aside to what? To their crooked ways. You see that language there? They turn aside to their own crooked ways. What this kind of gives us is, you know, we can infer from this, I'd say, that this was always in their hearts to do anyway. You know, it's their crooked ways. And what's going to end up happening is, what does it say that God will do? Well, with those people, the Lord will lead away with who? See, you hear the language? He's going to lead those people away with somebody else, the evildoers. And so, who were these people? These people were just imposters. These people were just, you know, saving face, masquerading themselves as righteous people. You know, I hope I don't get too much into other people's psalms whenever I go back into these psalms, but let's go to Psalm chapter 78. I just did it right there. I didn't want to do that, but I said Psalm chapter. I didn't mean to say that, but Psalm 78. I never thought about saying that, by the way, or accidentally saying that until, as Andrew brought up in his lecture yesterday, everything's dissected at the School of Preaching. And I think it was D.J. Kessinger that really used to get on us about that, about saying psalm chapter. He's like, it's not chapters, it's just a psalm. But anyway, Psalm 78, let's look at verses 34 through 37. And this is just a show here, this kind of mindset. And it's comical to me. It's not really comical. I mean, it's sad. But this is just to show that mindset of people, of God's people, never, you know, saying that they love God, saying that they care about God, but you know what? They really don't, at least in this text. So look at verse 34. You know what? Let's go back to verse 32. In spite of all this, okay, it's talking about the works of God and all that. In spite of all this, they still sinned. Who's they? It's the Israelites. They still sinned. Despite his wonders, they did not believe. So he made their days vanish like a breath, and their years in terror. Okay, now listen, watch what happens. When he killed them, they sought him. They repented and sought God earnestly. So you think, okay, well, that's a good thing, right? They're showing remorse. Mm-mm. Nope. Keep reading. They remember that God was their rock, the Most High God, their Redeemer. But, verse 36, but they flattered him with their mouths. They lied to him with their tongues. Their heart was not steadfast toward him. They were not faithful to his covenant. What does that sound like? You know what that sounds like to me? That sounds like people who are fake. You know, God's punishing me, so I'm going to turn around and just give him lip service. You know, I've been reading this. It's a classic, and it's by Dale Carnegie. It's called How to Win Friends and Influence People. And he says in there, you know, there's a difference between flattery and true appreciation. He says that in that book. And he says, if you're intelligent enough, you can pick up on it. You can pick up on when somebody's just trying to butter you up or be flattering in order to get something for themselves, or whether somebody truly appreciates you. And let me ask you this question. You think if you're intelligent enough to do that, you think if Dale Carnegie knows the difference between that, you think God knows the difference between whether or not you're just trying to flatter him with your mouth or flatter him with your presence, or whether you truly appreciate him? You think he knows the difference? Yeah, he definitely knows the difference. And this is exactly why the psalmist says, all these people who are acting like this, all these people who are just giving you lip service, all these people are going to turn to their crooked ways, and you are going to lead them away with all those evildoers. They may have fooled some people on earth, but they're not fooling you. And they're going to get justice. Okay, let's get back to our psalm. The psalm ends with, peace be upon Israel. Okay? It's a great ending. Peace be upon Israel. All right, so I have just a few minutes here. Let me get into some application. You know, this whole psalm is about protection, right? I know I didn't speak much about protection because I just kind of wanted to do an exposition of the text first, but don't we all want protection in life? I mean, is that so much to say? You know, let me submit something to you here. I want you to consider this with me. We want protection, even if it's psychologically, and here's what I mean. You know, there's a lot of people who won't get up and speak publicly. And I'm not just talking about preaching or, you know, when it deals with religion. I'm just talking about in general. A lot of people, even if it's in front of like a classroom, a lot of people don't like getting up and speaking in front of people. You know, some studies say that right ahead of the fear of death is the fear of public speaking. And you know why that is? I think here's why that is. Because when you get up and you speak in front of people, you're open to criticism, you know? You're open to humiliation, and at that, public humiliation. You're open to, well, they may laugh at me. Well, I might get something wrong. Well, I might... Okay, we can go on and on and on. The point is, so what do we usually do? So we usually, instead of public speak, we kind of sit back. And why do we do that? So we can protect ourselves from our vulnerability, from our weaknesses, from people laughing at us, from humiliation. You see, we seek protection even if it's psychologically, don't we? I mean, sure we do. Okay? But we also seek protection Physically, eh? I mean, how many women are in here? Raise your hand if you're a woman in here. I know there's more women here than that. My goodness. Okay. I don't know, you know, if all you guys carry a purse. I said guys when I was talking about women, but you know the euphemism. I don't know if all you women carry purses, okay? It's 2019. You know, not all women carry purses now, all right? But if you carry a purse, I'd say, you know, you might have a little, you know, bottle probably this big that's called pepper spray, right? You might. You might not, but some of you might. Why do you use that? Well, you know, when I'm walking down the street, I like to, you know, if I catch an aroma, I like to spray it in front of me, just waft it in front of me, you know, it smells good. Now I use it for a breath freshener. You know, no, obviously not, right? Why do you use it? You use it for protection, right? Okay. You know, we got a lot of men in here, and men usually don't carry pepper spray, but you know what some men carry is steel, right? Now I don't know if anybody in here is carrying that this morning. I gotta watch what I say, you know, I don't want to upset anybody. But the point is, why do we carry that kind of stuff? You know, for those who do. It's for protection, that's why. So listen, we want protection psychologically, right? We want protection for physical purposes, so we want protection physically, right? Okay, so we all want it. Well, who can give us protection then? Who can give us that protection that we want? Boy, I'm going to have to really hurry up here. Who can give us that protection that we want and that we crave? And that's God. God's going to be able to give us that protection. And I want to go over three things very quickly as to why God can give us that protection and why He's able to. So the first thing is God can give us protection because God is everywhere. Go back to the Psalm real quick. Verse 2. Look at this. As the mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds His people. You know why God can give us protection? Because God is everywhere. Don't we talk about that? That God is omnipresent. He's everywhere at once. He's not confined to space. God isn't confined to any space, so He's everywhere. He encompasses all things. Let me give you an illustration, you know. We all want protection, right? And we all want somebody to be there for us. But you know, sometimes in life, people just aren't going to be there for you. So let's have an example here. Let's say you're a housewife and your husband's working, your kids are at school, and you're home alone all day. And you may say, well, you know, goodness, I hope, hope nobody comes and knocks on the door. I hope nobody, you know, sketchy comes over and, you know, tries to break in or something. Because, you know, look, you know, I don't have a dog. And maybe the dog that, you know, we have a dog, but our dog doesn't have any teeth. Okay. But, you know, it's like, well, I don't have a dog. And, you know, the kids are at school. And you know, the gun safe, I don't know the code to it. And you know, husband's at work. And so, wait, what are you saying there? What you're saying there is that you have somebody that could protect you, your husband. But he's not there. You see how important it is for somebody to be there all the time? You know who that person is? It's God. God's always there because God's everywhere. And now, no, God's not going to be able to, you know, physically intervene and kill an intruder or something. But God's going to be there to protect you from your vulnerabilities, from your weaknesses. God's going to be able to be there to protect you from these things that you struggle in life. And He said He's going to watch over us, and He truly, truly will. So, you know, God is everywhere. God was there for Jesus as well, wasn't He? You know, when Jesus, in the garden, and Jesus was praying there to God. You know, His human side, Jesus needed God. He was praying to God, He needed God. And what do we end up seeing in Luke's account? What ends up happening after He gets done praying? Angels were there ministering to Him. So God was there, wasn't He? What about when Jesus was tempted? Over Matthew's account at the end of the temptations, He needed God. And who was there? God sent angels to minister to Him. When Jesus was baptized, who was the first one to shout from heaven? God. And then the Spirit came as a dove and rested on Jesus. You know, even when Jesus needed God, God was there. God's everywhere. God's there. All right, the second thing is, look at the text. Verse 2 still. Okay, the Lord surrounds His people from this time forth and from ever and forevermore. So not only is God everywhere, but secondly, God's always there. He's always there. He's never going to leave. That's a beautiful concept, isn't it? You know, what if God needed to take a rain check? What if you prayed to God and you pray, you know, I'm going through a really tough time in life. I need help with this. I need you to help me. And what if God went, you know what? I get it. You know, you're going through a lot right now. Okay? I'm not going to say you're not going through something. But look, I got so much on my plate. I mean, I literally just had 1 million people pray to me right there. You know, I'm sorry. I know you need somebody. That's not me. Could you imagine how depressing that would be? When nobody else is there for you in life, you think, well, at least I have God. And what if even God isn't there for you? But you know what, brethren? That's not how God is it? God's always there. You go to Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 16, it says that we can go to the throne of grace with what? With confidence. With boldness, we can draw near to the throne of grace. We can go with confidence because we know that God will always be there. God will always answer us. He cares about us. What does it say in Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5? What does the Hebrew writer there say? Be content with your life. Remember, for he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Certainly, God is not only everywhere, brethren, but God, he's always there. He's never going to leave. He's never going to leave as long as you don't leave him. All right? And the third thing is, very quickly, not only is God everywhere, not only is God always there, but look at verse 3. For the scepter of wickedness shall not rest on the land allotted to the righteous, lest the righteous stretch out their hands to do wrong. Thirdly, you know, God's always fair, isn't he? You think about that. God is just. God is always fair. God knows how to be fair with you and I. God knows who the wicked are, and he knows who the righteous are, and he can discern between the two. That's because of his wisdom. Isn't that one thing that Solomon asked for? Asked for wisdom to discern, and God gave it to him? That's one of the things that God has, wisdom to discern. He knows who's righteous, and he knows who's wicked. And he can discern between those two things. You know, this is a pretty important thing, brethren, because you go over to in Micah chapter 2 and also in chapter 3, but in Micah chapter 2, you know, it talks about, you know, if there was a preacher for this land coming in and preaching of, you know, strong drink and wine, he'd be a preacher for this people. And you go over to Micah chapter 3, and it says that the priests were teaching for a price, and the judges were judging for a bribe, and the prophets were divining for money. And you know, there's no justice. It's just all crookedness in the leadership of Israel. You go to Ezekiel chapter 35, you see the exact same thing with the leaders and the shepherds of Israel not feeding the flock, but feeding themselves on the shepherds. They're on the sheep, right? They're feeding themselves with the sheep. And there's no justice there. You know, it's all crookedness. There's no fairness there in that. There's no fairness in preaching for a price. There's no fairness in judging for a bribe. There's no fairness in that. You know, but there's fairness in God, and God's going to be a judge, and God's going to be a righteous judge, and he's going to know if you're righteous, and truly know if you're righteous. Anyone can put on a face. Anyone can masquerade themselves as something they're not, but you are not going to be able to fool God. You're not going to be able to trick God. God's going to be fair with you, and so you should have hope, and you should have the realization that if you truly are righteous, and maybe nobody else sees it, or maybe nobody else appreciates it, God's going to. God's going to be fair with you. He's going to be fair with me. What did Jesus say in John chapter 10? Jesus said, I know my sheep, and my sheep know me. God knows who we are. But the only way that God knows who we are is if we know who God is. We need to reach out our hands to God as well and seek God. Remember what Jesus said? And I lay down my life for the sheep. The reason the Father loves me. It's for I lay down my life. God cares about you and me. This is a big deal, to be fair, to be righteous, to be just. Sometimes we don't realize, I think, how big of a deal it is, you know? Look, we have a lot of great policemen all over the nation, don't we? I appreciate our policemen so much for all that they do. I appreciate everyone who works in a public way, in active service. You know, believe it or not, I appreciate our Congress. I appreciate our president. I appreciate the political party, if there is one, that I would adhere to. But you know what? It doesn't matter how much trust you put in the police. It doesn't matter how much trust you put in Congress. It doesn't matter how much trust you put in your political party. It doesn't matter how much trust you put in the president. Because even if all of those things were doing their best to be as just and as perfect as they could, you know what they will never be? They will never, ever be completely, perfectly fair and just with you. Not in every instance. Never. But there is one person who can be, and that's God. Brethren, don't you want somebody like that to protect you? Someone who's going to be everywhere, someone who's always going to be there, and not only that, someone who's going to be fair with you? You know, that's who the Israelites wanted to protect them. And the psalmist said, you know what? You got it. God's going to protect you. God's going to love you, and God's going to care for you. That same God is our God. He's our God too. He's going to be there to protect us. He's always going to be there. He's always going to care for us. And He's always going to be fair to us. We serve a just God. We serve a just God.